Thank you, Dan. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I've ever had a finer introduction, and I really appreciate that. Meeting you has been my great pleasure. I want to thank Dick and Janine and just everybody who has just been made this such a special and wonderful time. I especially want to thank Paul, who dragged me around and things, took me to buy a shirt when my bags didn't arrive, compliments of Delta Airlines, and just everybody, George and Lois, who have been so very good to me, just everybody. I just am profoundly grateful for the opportunity to be here. It's kind of sad that it's coming to an end. One, I miss you, and two, I have to fly for the next day and a half or something like that to get home, but it was worth whatever it takes to get here, and I'm just really delighted to have been part of this. This is my first trip to the islands, and I can promise you it won't be my last. You truly live in a paradise, and it's beautiful, of course, but that isn't what makes it a paradise. What makes it a paradise is you live here, and I am grateful that you shared some of that with me. I am a member of the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you haven't been there, I would urge you to come. It's a wonderful place, and we have a lot of really good sobriety there. I was telling somebody a little earlier that I led a meeting late last year at lunchtime, and there were 23 people in the meeting, and over half of them were sober longer than me and active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been around a few 24 hours. My sobriety date's May the 13th, 1973, so in about 15 days, by the grace of God, I'll celebrate 28 years of being with you folks. I know I don't look that old, but I am. Before I forget, I want to thank the speakers. It's difficult to get up and speak sometimes, and in times like this it is, because every speaker has just been magnificent, and every one of them has given me something that I'll carry away in my heart. I had not known Sean Brownie before, but I had heard about him many times. We have a lot of friends in common, and my friend Ken, we've known one another for nearly 20 years, and I truly love him, every time I hear him, I've heard him many, many times, but every time I hear him, I tell myself, remember that now, remember that, you know. And then I forget, and I have to come back and, you know, hear him again. The other thing I'd like to say is that if you've got some place to go after the meeting, don't worry, we'll be out of here in time, because a guy I sponsor named Steve M. says that in North Carolina, you never have to be alone unless you talk over an hour. So we'll be out of here. I was born in a small town. I'm a naturalized citizen of North Carolina. My wife was born and raised there. But I was born in a small town in Ohio, a place called Martin's Ferry. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. It's been canceled. But it's on the Ohio River just south of Pittsburgh, and Paul's hometown. And I would have told you that I grew up in poverty, and I'd have been wrong about that too. I'm good about being wrong. And I had 10 brothers and sisters in my Irish. I won't tell you what church I went to. Something to do with bingo, but I won't say anything else. Okay. And I really thought that we were poor. You know, we had no automobile, no television, nothing. And I'd have been dead wrong, because I had a mother who every day that I let her would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me, and I had a dad who every day I let him would spend time with me. And that's great wealth, and I know that now. I've known a lot of people who haven't been blessed with those kinds of things, and I'm profoundly grateful for that. And yet, you know, this whole thing called alcoholism seems to be such a spiritual illness, because what it did was it prohibited me from seeing the love that surrounded me my whole life. I was loved by virtually everyone who knew me, and yet because I had alcoholism, I couldn't experience it. I had a friend who's gone now, but he used to say that alcoholics aren't loved the way they need to be loved. That's the problem. And doesn't matter how you love us. If you don't love us the way we need to be loved, we don't feel loved. And it's always the way you haven't done it, in case you're interested. So, And the other thing I remember about being little was being afraid. I didn't know that fear wasn't a natural state of life. I thought everybody was afraid. We were just waiting. I was always on edge, just waiting, and something was going to happen, and it wasn't going to be good, and it was going to happen at any moment, and I was waiting. I was always waiting for this thing to happen. And it never did, but it doesn't matter. If you live in that sort of anxiety, then it becomes part of you. And you find ways to relieve that. I remember when I was a very little boy, I had a horrible speech impediment, and nobody could understand anything I said other than the people who loved me the most. And they had me convinced I was perfectly normal. And I went off to the first grade, and the nun asked if anybody knew any songs. It was the first day of school, and all the parents were there, and said, does anybody know any songs? And my mother had told me I was quite a singer, so I put my hand up, and my mother sort of slid to the back of the group, and just wanted to make sure they got a good look at me, I guess, and didn't mind being away. And I stood up and sang that old favorite, I'm a grand old fag, I'm a high-flying fag. And my mother wept. She said she'd never heard anything quite so beautiful in her life. And that's where I grew up. I grew up in a society where everything was for the children. I remember I was born in 1943, and in 1949 we had that huge steel strike, and it paralyzed the whole area that I lived in. And the grocery stores eventually ran out of food. You know, they were all corner grocery stores, and if they didn't have any money, they couldn't buy anything. And they ran out of food and closed up and on. And I remember the adults would, we had picnics every day. That's what they called them. They'd be picnics. And all the adults would get together at one house, and they would cook what there was, and the kids would eat, and they would eat. And I was convinced that nobody loved me. I had a mother who never finished high school until all of us had, and she read a book a day her entire life. She raised 11 of her own children, and they raised some children that just didn't have any place else to go. And she went back and finished high school, and she took her college entrance boards and outscored everybody in the family. And she said, "Well, I've been through high school 12 times now." And we would do things like we had a reading hour, and you weren't permitted to do homework during reading hour. You had to read just for the sake of reading. And we had a word of the week. And what happened was everybody would take turns, and they would come up with a word that they didn't know. And you were supposed to look it up and get the definition, and then you would share it with the family, and then everybody in the family was supposed to use that word during the course of the week. And my little brothers and sisters would come up with a word. We always acted like we had never heard it before. I would have told you I was poor. I would have told you that my problem was that my father never told me he loved me. And it was either that or mother had a square nipple. There was something very wrong in my life. I missed it. That was it. It was a condition called alcoholism, and I just missed it. And I just discovered early on that what was important was getting attention. And I studied very, very hard. And I was a reasonably good student, but my sister was a superior student. So that didn't work well. So in pretty short order, I began to get into trouble. I was just mischievous. I mean, I wasn't a hoodlum, but I was just mischievous. And if we'd have had any money, I think I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. And I was constantly, being suspended from school for a day or two or something like that. And in those days, it was always your fault. Because nuns didn't do anything wrong. So you got suspended from school, and then you went home and got punished. And it was a twofer. They didn't know anything at all about the law, double jeopardy. And one of the things that happened to me in high school was I met some spiritual people, and I didn't recognize them as spiritual. And I know they're spiritual now because they're like you. They're filled with joy, and they're happy. One of them was Sister Victoria. And I never forget Sister Victoria. She was a nun who ran the library. And And when I served detention with Sister Victoria, and what you did when you served detention was you made rosary beads. You know, those are things that Catholics pray on. She'd set me behind a magazine rack, and she used to say that every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king, you know, silly stuff like that. So we call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary and things. And she told me I had to make rosary beads about every day. She put me behind a magazine, Max. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. So you give me a wire and pliers and these beads, and I'd sit back here and I'd make rosary beads. And mine were a little different. Instead of 10 beads in each decade, I made them with 11 beads in each decade. In 4 years, I made hundreds of meat and rosary beads. And what they would do is they'd take these seeds and they'd mail them to the missions around the world. And she never caught on. You know what I mean? She just never caught on. And I had to tell her before I left, you can't not go and not let them know it, because it would have been a wasted 4 years. And so I went to her and I said, "Sister, you know what I've been doing for the last 4 years?" And she said, "Yes, you sly little prince." She said, "I know what you've been doing." She said, "You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries." And she said, "And I know why you've been doing it." And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest idea. Right? She said, "You've been doing it so that people all over the world are going to pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you just hate people like that? I shortly after I graduated from high school, I joined the service. Now, the reason I joined the service is because I didn't know what to do. And it seemed to me everybody in the world knew what they were doing but me. And it was like everybody had the big picture but me. I knew I had to go away, because if you went away, they wouldn't know you didn't know what it was you were supposed to be doing. They would think you were doing it. So I took my very first inventory. I stood in front of the mirror, and I take my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways, and I stuck my chest out. And whatever else I was a born killer. I was 5'1" tall, and I weighed 113 pounds, and so went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And I wasn't yet old enough to do that, and so I forgot to tell my parents my plan, and so the recruiter showed up at the house with the papers for them to sign. My poor mother lost it. She just fell apart like a cheap suit. I mean, she was crying and everything, and I remember she cried all night, and she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." The next morning, with that vote of confidence, we got a taxi cab and went over to Wheeling, West Virginia. And I got on a bus, a Greyhound bus, and I went to Pittsburgh. It was 60 miles away. It was the second longest trip I'd ever been on. Yeah, and it was a bad year. They took you if you had a pulse. So that afternoon, I was sworn in the Marine Corps and with three guys from Pittsburgh who I'd never met before. But they clearly understood the big picture. You could just tell by looking at people. They understood. I mean, it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out you didn't know what was going on either. And that's what makes life so much fun. We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's next. And that's what makes it so much fun. And that night, I had my second drinking experience. Let me tell you about my first drinking experience. I think it's important to drink if you're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met some members I have some grave questions about, but that's another topic. First time I drank, I was 5 years old. I was at home with my brother, Dumb Denny. He's four, I was at home. We didn't go out a lot when I was five, and my father was watching us, mom was either at the bingo or having a baby or something, and I guess Dad thought it'd just be funny, and he gave us a beer. You know, gave me a beer and Dumb Denny a beer, and he had a beer. And I don't talk about it much anymore, but I clearly remember that he gave me, I had those little jelly glasses that used to have characters on them, cartoon characters. And mine had Superman on it. Now, I don't know if that's significant. A psychologist might, but I drank my first beer, and nothing happened. Nothing. Biggest disappointment in my life. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He was... He was rolling around under the table singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and other drinking songs, And my father wrestled him to the ground and got his clothes off and put his jammies on him, and, you know, the kind of with the trap door and everything. And Denny was just having the time of his life, and he said, get ready for bed, son. And he said, don't tell your mother about this, and I'll take you to the movies. Well, I was game, because, you know, they don't negotiate a lot with you when you're five. But Denny wasn't hearing it. He was just having the time of his life. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. We shared a room, and little Denny stood up in his crib, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol, and his wife has become a med. And you know, it's the strangest thing. It's sad. It's really sad. But Denny just never really made it. You know what I mean? He just never made it. It's just awful. We're not proud of this, but Denny did some strange things. I'll give you some examples. Denny grew up and went to one college. Oh, it gets worse. He had one major. And he graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing. And he went to one graduate school. Graduated first in his class. He had like 8 job offers. He took one. You know? And about 5 years ago, he retired as a vice president in a large international corporation. You know, the strangest thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he let it slip through his fingers, you know? I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. Well, that afternoon I was sworn in the Marine Corps. I drank for the second time. And these guys I joined with said, hey, kid, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a beer and wait for the train. You want to come along? I said, that's just what I was thinking. So I followed him over there, and we went into this bar in Pittsburgh. And I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh. I know Paul certainly has, but I don't know if you have been. And I'm going to tell you, this place is filled with real men. You know the kind, you know. And all the real men have real women with them. And that's how you can tell. And guys like me used to get what was left. So I follow these guys in, and we go over and sit at a table. And the bartender, he's a real man. He said, what do you want? And my first impulse was, oh, no, a quiz. I thought, you know, the way life worked was when you least expected it, someone was going to say, take out a blank sheet of paper, put your name in the upper left-hand corner, and they were going to ask a bunch of questions. And I studied all the time. I just never studied the right stuff. So I didn't know how to answer this question, so I watched what they did. And they ordered a beer, so I did too. You know, some years later, a psychologist was to speak to me and my wife, and he'd scratching his chin, you know how they do, and he said, tell me, why did you drink in the first place? And I knew that was important. I knew it was important, and I went home, and I had a private place and down by the stream near the apartment building we lived in, and I got a bucket of ice and a fifth of scotch, and I went down by the stream, and I thought about it, and I wrote a little, and then I couldn't read what I wrote, so I just thought, and why did I drink in the first place? And I couldn't come up with anything, so I went down to the local bar, and it was a tough place called Jim and Max Sunnybrook Farm on Indian Head Highway. And I'm sitting next to a guy, a big guy, rode a motorcycle, did something. I said to him, pardon me, sir, why do you drink in the first place? And he said, shut up or I'll kill you. So, and I just couldn't figure it out. And I knew somehow if I figured out why I drank in the first place, I wouldn't do it. You know, And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out why I drank in the first place. You know, I'm 17 years old. I'm 5 feet 1 inches tall. I weighed 113 pounds. I just joined an organization I knew nothing about. The only thing I knew about the Marine Corps is they took a certain number of men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew. And I'm sure I was never going to come home alive again. And I'm in a bar filled with real men and real women. And they're all wondering, what's he doing in here? And the three guys I was with ordered a beer, and I just didn't have the intestinal fortitude to ask for a sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't care why you drank in the first place. Because it doesn't matter. It's got nothing to do with anything. You know? What matters is what happens to you after you drink. And that's when the music started. Somewhere between the second and third drink, my life changed. And it changed in a way it was to dictate the rest of my life. I remember I stood up. Didn't mean to stand up. I couldn't keep from standing up. And I looked in the floor 6 feet, 4 inches below me. My right shoulder was out to here. My left shoulder was, and the muscles were rippling through my body. And that mind that had been filled with fear and doubts, like, boom, it was crystal clear all of a sudden. And I remember thinking, of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? And I understood the big picture. It was marvelous. And I looked around this place, and my heart broke. Because the place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. You know, male-eyed women with them looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And it's an amazing time. And I spent the rest of the evening just going around answering questions. I was answering questions before they asked them. I mean, I was all over this thing. It was incredible. And it came time to go. And it seemed to me, now this may not be entirely accurate, but it seemed to me the people were saying, please don't go. And I said, I have to go. I have to go make the world safe for democracy. And we went and got on a train. Now, I assume we got on a train because I woke up on a train. And I was to make that assumption quite often in the next 12 years. So the Marine Corps had provided me with a Pullman coach on this train, which is very nice of them. I think they recognized quality when they saw it. Someone had wet the floor of that Pullman coach, and whoever it was, they had wet me too. I was laying there, and I got up, and I changed clothes, and I was again 5 feet 1 inch tall. I was 300 miles from home, which is 3 times as far as I've ever been from home in my life. I was terrified, but now I knew what to do. I never knew what to do. So I go off the train. The guys are waiting for me on the platform, and they said, what took you so long? And I wasn't telling them that someone wet the floor. I just let it pass, and they said, where are you going? I said, I'm going over to have a drink. And they said, for breakfast? I said, of course. And I went over and I began to drink. And somewhere between the second and third drink, it happened again. Now, I never ever got back to Pittsburgh, but it was better than reality. I spent the next 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh. Never made it. Got to McKeesport, got to suburbs, never got to Pittsburgh. But I was willing to pay whatever it took to go there. Frequently, I fly through Pittsburgh Airport when I speak at places. And I always think of how cheap the ticket is now. And I spent 12 years paying everything I had to get back to Pittsburgh, to get back to that feeling of ease and comfort that I experienced the first time. It was never, ever that good again. I was much drunker, but I never had that feeling of ease and comfort like I did that time. And that evening, I fell off a train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. I don't know exactly what happened. Something moved the bottom step or something, but I fell across the next set of tracks. There was a very rude man they had sent there to greet us who was he was hurling obscenities at myself and other young men who had gone down there to die for their country. And I tried to explain to him that he'd do a lot better with us if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to relay to him, But they say you can learn from every experience. And what I learned from that experience is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that experience. I don't mean to be indelicate, but you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time in case you're interested. And then I walked fire watch all night. And the next morning they put me on a bus and took me to a place called Paris Island. And I was welcomed into the Marine Corps. And I must tell you, it was the greatest, one of the finest things ever happened to me. I loved everything about it. I loved it from the beginning. You know, once I figured out that their job was to scream at you, it was all right with me. And I often wondered why I loved them. I fell in love with them immediately. And I often wondered why, and I think I figured it out. My whole life, I guessed at life. I had no earthly idea what my job description was. I didn't know what was expected of me. My life was just vague. I spent 17 years guessing at life. And I don't know if you can relate to this at all. But all of a sudden, I'm in a place where they have a very, very clear idea what they want from you, and they're not a bit shy about sharing it with you. And so I understood, and I've discovered that I'm a doer. If I know what I'm supposed to do, I'll go do it. My problem is knowing what to do. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous is a perfect place for a guy like me. Because if I get a sponsor, a good sponsor, he's not a bit shy about sharing what it is I need to go do. And I just show up, I suit up, I get my orders, and I go. And I think that's why Alcoholics Anonymous has worked so well for me. And the Marine Corps was the place I was going to spend the rest of my life. I'll never forget. I was there at Paris Island about a week. And I said, I'm going to stay as long as they let me. And I won Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award. Every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps one time, and I worked hard to get a commission, and I would have been the youngest lieutenant in the Marine Corps, except for one thing, and that one thing is that I'm alcoholic. And what being alcoholic simply means is that I'll fall in love with a way of life. If you're kind of new to this, and you haven't picked up on the enthusiasm around here, this is not unusual. This is the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's tremendous enthusiasm. And I fell in love with a way of life, and then gradually or not so gradually, I would end up violating every principle associated with that way of life. And I would end up leaving, and I would blame them for what happened to me. And that's what it means to be alcoholic. Oh, there's a lot of other stuff that goes with it. But what it means, I think, more than anything else, is a progressive illness where I become less and less the human being I wanted to be. That's why Danny mentioned it, that my goal is to be a better husband, better father, better sponsor, better pigeon. I'm not French, I'm a pigeon. I want to be a better son than I was this time last year. Because the 12 years I drank every year, I was less of what I wanted to be than I was the year before. And that's the horror of alcoholism, to watch myself deteriorate like that. You know, I ended up having to get out. Through a series of unfortunate events, nobody got hurt, fortunately, but I ended up leading a patrol in a blackout in combat. We took fire, we returned fire. It was up to me. I'm sure nobody on either side got hurt, but I just knew that the Marine Corps was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. Then I went on to do what I had to do, and in my case, it was some horrible stuff. I ended up married somehow. I really don't know how that happened. Back in the 60s, they used to call pregnancy an engagement period. So we ended up married, and I had a wonderful daughter named Kelly. And then somehow, I don't know how that happened, right after that, my wife's pregnant again. And I discovered just what had happened to me on the inside. Alcoholism really is an inside job. On the outside, I was still looking pretty good. I had a responsible job. I was directing genetics laboratories at Georgetown University. And I was doing some things and getting some awards and doing some publications and that sort of thing. But on the inside, I was dying. And with our second pregnancy, one night I passed out on the floor watching a test pattern on the TV. I feel bad for young alcoholics. They don't get to watch test patterns anymore. And again, someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and I was lying there in my underwear, which is the way I like to watch test pattern. And my wife had invited the neighbors over because she was upset just because she was having a baby and couldn't wake me up. She always panicked. So I woke up, and the neighbors were standing there looking at me. It's a private thing to watch a test pattern, and I was embarrassing. And I got up, and I was drunk, and I got dressed somehow, and I sped across town, and I delivered her to the hospital that I worked in, and I demanded they take care of her. Just the craziness that goes with alcoholism, the embarrassment she must have been feeling, God bless her. And she had the baby, and our little baby weighed about a pound and a half, and she was almost 3 months premature, and I had just gotten back home, and a phone rang, and my wife was crying and said, please come back to the hospital. Our baby has highly membrane disease, and they don't think she'll live. Please be here. And I didn't want to be. I was just tired. I don't know if you can relate to this. I was just tired. There was nothing left anymore. Everything was gone. And I went back to that hospital, and we began a watch that was just incredible. And the chief resident was a girl I had gone to high school with back in Ohio, and she said that they had just gotten a negative respirator. It was an experimental machine at that time, and it was the first one in the District of Columbia, and they just put it together 2 days before this little girl was born, and she said, we'd like to put her on it. We don't think it'll make any difference, but we'd like to put her on it. And I said, do whatever you think you need to do. And I was watching my wife, and she's walking up and down the hall, and this thousand-yard stare, and she was in a state of shock. And I watched this little girl. We had an office across from the neonatal nursery, and I watched this little girl fight for every breath. And And they would say to me, you know, you're the parent, you need to go in and touch her and so that she bonds with you and everything. And I didn't want her to bond with me because it had occurred to me that anything I ever cared about was gone. And I went in and I did what I was supposed to do, not because I wanted to do it. I did it because people were watching, and I was afraid of what they would think of me if I didn't do it. And I knew what to do. I'd watched my father. My father was the greatest father and husband in the world. And I know what he'd have done. He'd have gone to my mother and he put his arm around her. And he said, "We can do this. With God's help, we can do this." And I knew what to do. I just couldn't do it. There was nothing left inside of me. And at 72 hours is a very critical time for these children. And I had drifted away from the church, and I loved the church. God, I was growing up, I loved the church. I loved the tabernacle. I was a little kid. Before I go play ball, I'd stop by the church and say, "Jesus, I'm going to go down and play some ball. I'd play second base, you know, and if you want, you can come and watch." And I just loved it. I never went by the church that I didn't stop in and visit and things. And here I am, deathly ill. I'm 27 years old, and I'd long since given up on this concept of God. But that night, I didn't know what else to do, so I went down into our little chapel in the hospital, and I got on my knees, and I begged God to let my little girl live. I said, "I'll do anything if you let her live. If you let her live, I won't drink." And I was drunk in 12 hours. And I want to remember that I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. There's a French mathematician and philosopher named Blaise Pascal. And Blaise said that God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned a favor. And I had created a God that would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. Thank goodness I was wrong. And she went on and miraculously lived. They said that she would be retarded from lack of oxygen. About 8 years ago now, she graduated with honors from Auburn University. I like to tell her that I think you can graduate from Auburn University and be retarded, but gee, you know, she. I was speaking down in Florida, and she lives in Alabama, and I called her, she was pregnant for the second time, and she'd had some kidney stones, and so she started having contractions. And I talked to her, and she said, "Daddy, I'm so scared." And I said, "Why?" She said, "I'm afraid I'm going to have this baby early, and she'll be like me." And I was able to say, "The greatest thing you could have is a baby like you." And you know, through the years, Kimberly has taught me so very much. She's taught me so very much. But you know, I had to go and lose that too. I had to lose everything before I was ready to come to you. And, you know, one day my wife just said to me, "I can't live like this anymore." And she asked me to leave, and I was relieved. I had deteriorated to the point where I couldn't even fake carrying responsibility anymore. And I went where I had to go in order to find you, and that was the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I was living in the basement of a house. And one morning, May the 13th, 1973, I went into what passed for a bathroom in this place, and had enough pills to kill me and three other people. And either began to take them or didn't. To this day, I don't know. What I do know is that I said aloud that you're 29 years old and at least we'll be over. And a voice spoke to me, a woman spoke to me and said, "When you're 29, it's not supposed to be over, it's supposed to be starting." And startled me. And you know, if you're in a fog and come out of it abruptly, you know you'd been in a fog. And it was like things were crystal clear just for a moment. And I remember that my estranged wife had given me a couple telephone numbers and said, "If I don't know what to do for you, maybe these people can help you." And I could only find one, and I called it. And later I found the other one was to Alcoholics Anonymous. But the one I called was to a treatment center. And I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know what they did. But my estranged wife said that maybe they can help you. And the woman answered the phone, and she had a British accent. And there's something soothing about that to me. I don't know why. Oh, they, you know, we had to run them out of here. But there's something very comforting about it. And I'll tell you why. When I started to learn to speak. I had to teach myself to speak. I didn't have speech pathologists and stuff where I was. They had steel trucks, but no speech pathologists. And I had some teachers who took an interest in me and things. And so I would get records. They said, get some records of someone who speaks very good English, and then listen to a word and say it. Listen to a word and say it. So I went to the library, and I said to the librarian, excuse me, do you have anybody who speaks real good English? And tell her three or four times, she finally understood what I was trying to say. So she gave me records of Winston Churchill. Spoke fairly good English. And so I would practice words listening to Winston Churchill. And I was the only kid in the Ohio Valley with a British accent. But at any rate, there was something soothing about that. The woman's name was Dorothy. And Dorothy later died of alcoholism. But at that time, she was sober. And she said the things I needed to hear. And 3 days later, and it was a horrendous 3 days, there was a time, you know, when there weren't places to take alcoholics. You know, I worked in one of the finest medical centers on the East Coast, and if you were alcoholic, you couldn't go where I worked. And so the woman said to me, do you need help stopping drinking? And that's a silly question. I never stopped. How would I know? And I said no, and it turned out I did need help, because for the next 3 days, strange things happened. I heard Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for 3 days. Lovely piece of music. But I put a nickel in the parking meter, and out would come Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And I'd stand there and listen to it, you know. And I always thought that, no offense, but I always thought that parking meters were taxation without representation anyway. So I was finally getting something out of my nickel. And I had to go on, this place. I had to try to borrow some money. So I borrowed money on my old alcoholic car. And I'm listening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in the bank, and then I realized the loan officer's looking at me peculiarly, and I suddenly realized that they didn't have Muzak. I was the only one hearing this, and it was just insane. And somehow I knew it was the right day, and I got in this thing that passed for a car, and I began to drive, and I just couldn't. I could drive maybe a mile, and a terror would strike me. I found out later they called them anxiety attacks, and you got to take Valium, but then they were running fits. That's what they called them, running fits. And I would run up and down the road, and I was sick, and I threw up, and I wet my pants, and I changed in my pants on the side of the road outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out of my pocket, and I wondered what had gone wrong. I was just a kid with all this potential, and I was saving it for when it got real bad, and it was gone. I don't know what happened to it. Somebody stole my potential. But I get to this place. It took me 5 hours to go 30 miles, and I got to this place, and I received two great pieces of information that day, and those pieces of information saved my life. One, a woman said to me, you haven't been bad, you've been sick. And the other thing that happened to me was they put me on a bus and sent me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I didn't know existed. I knew it used to exist, but I didn't know it existed. There was a man stood at the door, much like the people with red shirts this weekend, and shook hands and welcomed you. This man shook my hand, and he said to me, you're new, aren't you? And my first thought was, oh, my God, he's psychic. And I found out now, we don't blink for a while. And then he said something to me. It was outrageous. He said, you know, son, he said, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. And I wanted to scream at him. I wanted to say, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. But he did know me. He knew me because I was an alcoholic. And he's kept his promise. From that day to this, I haven't had to take a drink. And he took me inside and he introduced me to an old woman, the oldest human being I ever saw in my life. And she got me a half a cup of coffee and sat next to me and patted me. The whole meeting, she patted me. And her skin's moving around. This old woman's patting me. And then she said to me, she said, you know, son, if you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And it's a funny thing happened to me. I began to cry, and I don't know where it came from. I didn't know that what I was alone. And I'd been alone probably my whole life. The only time I fit or the only time I belonged was somewhere between the second and third drink. And then at the end, even that didn't work. You know, I'd lay next to the woman I was married to, and I knew she was a stranger. And I lived such a dishonest life that no one knew me. They only knew what I wanted them to know or something of it. They never knew me. I'd go in and little Kelly and little Kimberly would be in their cribs asleep at night, and I'd rub their little heads, and I knew they couldn't be mine. because nothing that nice could have anything to do with me. What I was completely and utterly alone. And gradually, oh so gradually, I became alive in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the beginning, it was absolute madness. And for those of you who are kind of new, fasten your belts. It's wonderful. It was a place where you discovered a problem and you went and found the answer. And if you don't find the answer in time, you drink. See? So once you find out the problem, the clock starts running. And I would frantically run around looking for the answer. And old-timers would always give me the answer. I go, thank God, you know. And one time, though, I went to an old-timer. I can't remember what the problem was. It was a big one. It was a June of 73. Everybody had it. And I told him, what's the problem? And I told him, and he said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, no. And he said, but I know a man who might. So he sent me down to the middle of Washington, D.C., to a place called the Metropolis Club. It used to be down in the Trailways bus station next to it in a condemned building. And he said, find this man. He can answer this for you. So I drove all the way downtown, and the guy's out on a 12-step call. And I said, look, I got to talk to this guy. I'm sober about 50 days. I'm just crazy as an outhouse rat. I don't know how you look so good reading that, reading how it works with 50 days, 40 days of sobriety. I've been hanging on from the ceiling. I was just crazy. And the guy came in. He'd been out on a 12-step call. And I said, I got to talk to you. And he said, well, have a seat. He said, we'll talk after the meeting. I said, I may not be alive after the meeting. And he said, no one sits next to me ever dies. So I sat right next to him. When the meeting was over, I told him my problem. I can't remember what I was, but it was a big one. And I never forget, he looked at me, and he was a beautiful man. He had beautiful eyes, and he had white eyebrows, and he was a black man. And he looked at me, and he shook his head, and he said, you know, son, he said, I wish I could help you. He said, but I don't know the answer to that. And I said, you were my last hope. And he said, let me make a suggestion. I said, anything. He said, don't drink, even if your ass falls off. And I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. I didn't understand that this isn't about solving problems. This is about finding the solution. It isn't about how we feel. If you don't like the way you feel, wait 5 minutes. Yeah? It's about learning to live a way of life that one, stops the destruction, and two, begins to reverse it. And that's what matters. That's what this is about. Alcoholics Anonymous is a solution. But it's a mad solution. And it's so much fun. I remember the things I couldn't do. I couldn't shop. I couldn't go in a grocery store. I couldn't be in a grocery store. I'd go crazy after a few minutes in a grocery store. So I devised this plan. I would run in and grab one of those little baskets, and I would grab what I absolutely had to have. I went every day, and I would get into the 10-item line, you know, and get out of there before I went crazy or had a heart attack or something. So I'm in this line, right, and I'm starting to sweat. Looked like Ken last night. It's done, that's why I said that. I'm in this line, and the guy, I guess it was a slow day or something like that. The guy goes, 1, 2, 3. He said, sir, you have 11 items. And I just lost it. And I just began to scream. I'm sorry, you're right, you're absolutely right. I don't deserve to shop here. And he said, it's okay. I said, no. And I turned around, and by then a couple of people were standing behind me. And I said, this man caught me trying to sneak 11 items for a 10-item lunch. I said, you ought to thank him. Well, they were looking at me. I mean, you know, they just want to buy a couple of things and go home. I mean, they don't want to, you know. And finally the manager came over and said, what's the matter? I said, you got to promote this man. He's taking 11 items. I started to cry. And I did what any normal person would do. I ran out of the store. No, all that's okay. What happened next was a big mistake. I called my sponsor. Don't ever call your sponsor after you do. He said, you did what? He said, you get your ass over. That was his favorite statement. You get your ass over. So I went over to his place, and he put me in a car. We drove back to Safeway on Wisconsin Avenue in Georgetown. I said, no, Dan, no. Yeah. Get in there. And so I went in there, and the manager came running over. He said, sir, are you all right? And I said, well, it's a tough life. Almost died of alcoholism. And I had a shop there for the next 6 months, and every time I went in there, that guy'd be in the line, you know. And I'd come in and go, 1, 2, 3, 4, ah, you know. So. I was always on the verge of just losing. I mean, just going over the edge. And I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep. A lot of people have this trouble. And so, you know, back then, fortunately, they didn't say, does anybody here have a problem? You know, at the meetings, you know, because they do it now, some of the meetings I go to. Like, anybody here have a problem? I always put out my hand and say, I got alcoholism. But, you know, somebody's mother had a square nipple and 50 untrained psychiatrists take a shot at it, you know. But what they used to do, at the end of the meeting, they would say, does anybody here want to bring something up? And I put my head up and say, what is it, kid? I say, I can't sleep. And they take turns. You know how they are. Nobody ever died from not sleeping. And it's just a suggestion like the rest of the program, but don't talk that way to somebody who hadn't slept in a week. I remember screaming, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. Nobody ever said it again. It was a wonderful thing. And then, you know, and I used to drive around all night when I couldn't sleep, and I'd read the monuments. You know, Washington, D.C. is a beautiful place, and I viewed all the wonderful things that Jefferson and Lincoln and all of them said, you know, engraved here and there. It was wonderful because the next day I couldn't remember what I'd read the day before, so it was like it was brand new every day. And one night I went down to the Jefferson Memorial, and I just laid down in the grass. I fell sound asleep. It was wonderful. I woke up about an hour later. I said, this is great. I said, the problem isn't that I can't sleep. I've been trying to sleep in the wrong place. So I went home and got a sleeping bag, and I came back and I laid it out, laid down, went right to sleep. It was amazing. And I woke up, somebody's kicking my foot, and it's a park policeman. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'll tell you what I'm doing here. And I told him my story, and he just looked at me, and he said, you mean this is the only place you can sleep? I said, well, it's the only place I found, you know. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, buddy. He said, anytime you need to sleep, you come on down here. So every few days, I'd get my sleeping bag and go to the Jefferson Memorial, and I'd lay there and look at the stars, and I'd hear, hey, Keith, is that you? I'd say, yeah, yeah. How many days? 60 days. Way to go. That's great. You want some coffee? I said, no, I better get some sleep. I have to go to work. And they said, well, don't worry. We'll keep an eye on you. You know, I was sober about 3 months, and I got a letter. I was invited to come to Paris and to study with a man named Jerome Lejeune, just died a few years ago. One of probably the greatest cytologists that lived at that time. And he was Pope John Paul's primary theologian when he died. A wonderful man, incredible man. And he invited me to come and study with him. And I knew I couldn't go because I had this thing figured out. I had this sponsored deal figured out. Sponsors find out what you really want to do and tell you no. That, you know. So I wasn't even going to give him the satisfaction. But I really wanted to go, so I went to lunch and I gave him the letter, and he read the letter and he just beamed. He said, this is wonderful. I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. I said, what do you mean I have to? He said, you have to go. He said, this isn't about you. He said, this is about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, 3 months ago, all you could do is crap your pants over there on Skid Row. He said, this is about Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he told me something. If you're new, please hear this. He said to me, he said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. And that's the truth. I found that in almost 28 years now. There's nothing I haven't been able to do if I prepare properly. We heard some of the preparation yesterday. I prepare by not having booze in my house. I don't play games with alcohol. I just don't do it. I just don't do it. For a number of reasons. Number one, I'm powerless over it. I don't have alcoholism. I have alcoholism. And number two, people look at what I do because I'm creeping up on being an old timer. I'm not there yet, but I'm creeping up on it. Okay? And people watch me. And the reason I'm alive today is because of the kind of examples you were in my life when I came here. That's why I'm alive today. And I want to be that kind of an example. I don't want ever to lead anyone astray in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I don't use bad language from the podium. And that's why I wouldn't take a woman I'm not married to a conference if I was speaking and things like that. Because I wouldn't. Because I think it's not the best I can be for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm not saying anybody else has to do that. But I don't want anybody to ever say to me and say, to ever look at me and say, I don't like AA because of the way he conducts himself. That's not much. I can't do much because I'm not that skilled. But I can do that. I went to France and I studied for a little while, and then I went to Rome and spent some time in a monastery, and I did things that I didn't think a guy could do, and I did them sober. I'd been to those places, but I'd been there drunk, and I had experiences that number in the thousands at this time, and I won't bore you with them, but just know that Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And the first year I was sober, I went to 500 meetings. I went to meetings in languages I didn't even speak, but heck, I drank in places where they spoke languages I didn't speak. And I went to 500 meetings the first year I was sober, and I probably went to 500 meetings the second year I was sober. And I go to a lot of meetings now. Now, meetings aren't Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just one thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they're important things that we do. Meetings won't keep you sober, but it will sure give you a mental readjustment from time to time. And that's what we need. What keeps me sober, of course, is working this program. I like to talk a little bit, if I can, about that father who never told me he loved me. And I've got a theory about being a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know anything about being a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but we are different. I know that. But I think there's a lot the same, but there are some things that are different. One of the things I know about being a man in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I can never be at peace if I don't get it right with Dad. And it doesn't matter what Dad is or did or anything. None of that matters. Until I got it right with Dad, I couldn't generate a decent relationship with God as I understood him. I couldn't have a decent relationship with a woman until I got it right with Dad. And, you know, my father never told me he loved me, and he was on my amends list. And I drove from Washington, D.C. to Ohio three times that I can remember, specifically to make amends to him. I would be in his presence for 5 minutes. For some reason, I'd get so angry I couldn't see straight. I'd get up and drive back to Washington. It's 300 miles. And finally, my dad said to my mother, "You know, he's a real fine boy, but he drives a long way for a cup of coffee." And he had no earthly idea what I was going through and the damage that had been done. I moved to North Carolina, and I bought a little house down on the ocean. I named it CZ Does It. And my father had never seen the ocean, because when you raise 11 of your own kids and other people's kids, you don't go on very many vacations. So I invited him to North Carolina, and asking my mom, he just retired, I said, "Would you mind keeping an eye on my house for me?" And he said, "You sure?" I said, "Yeah, positive." And so he kept an eye on it for 6 years. He kept an eye on it. And I was an officer with a hospital corporation, and I was traveling quite a bit, and I was living in Alabama at the time. But I'd go by and see Dad, and we sat in a rocking chair together out looking at the ocean, the other ocean. And we'd sit there rocking and talking, and one day he just started to talk. And he said to me, "Son," he said, I was telling him I didn't like my job much and things. And the reason was that I couldn't have a real regular AA life, because I was always on the road. And I'm a guy who needs a regular AA life. I'm not a guy who could live in two places, because I have a responsibility to the guys I sponsor, and I couldn't tell them I'll see you in 6 months and that sort of thing. But at any rate, I was not thriving. And so we're about 12, 13 years, so I was talking to my dad, and he said, "You know, son," he said, "Remember your first day's work?" And I said, "Well, no." He said, "You worked at the bowling alley." So I remember where I worked. And he said, "Well, your first day I took you to lunch." He said, "We went to Louis' hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had?" And I said, "I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog?" And "Of course you did, you loon." He always calls me a loon. And he said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Well, probably an orange pop. I always drank orange pop." He said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you drank root beer." He said, "I think you thought men who worked drank root beer, because I drank root beer." He said, "I explained to you what it was like to do a good day's work for a good day's pay, and that you owed your boss respect and he owed you respect." That's 12 years old. My father was teaching me how to grow up. And he said, "I walked you down to the bus stop and said to your son, I had to go to the next town. And he said, 'Do you want me to come with you the first day?' And you said, 'No thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself.' And he said, I stood and watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back. I recall what the book tells me, that people treat me the way I make them treat me. He said, and from then on, you never let me do anything for you. He said, you didn't even let me help you go to college, and all your brothers and sisters let me help. He never owned a car until the last kid finished college. And I realized how I had wronged him. It wasn't because I was nuts in another country, and, you know, it wasn't because I didn't show up for 3 or 4 days. That's all that. Of course, he worried about that, of course. But that isn't why I owed him an amends. The great damage I did my father is I never let him do what he did best, which would be my father. And you know, a month later, I needed to borrow some money from him. And I paid him back, and from that day till this, we've been like that. I let him be my father. Last year was a special year for me. I got to speak at Founders Day, and it's a great, for a guy from Ohio, I always like to say that that is where AA began. It did not begin in Southern California. It may have prospered there, but it didn't begin there. And I won't say that Clancy isn't one of the co-founders. I always do that, but I won't do that. But I spoke, and it was the week that we were supposed to have our family reunion. And I said to Dad, I'll be there. I'll just be a little bit late because I'll be in Akron, but I'll be there. And my father told the rest of the family, if Keith can't be here, we're not going to have it. So we had it the following week. Now, 27 years before that, nobody would tell me when the family reunion was. Yeah? It's a true story. The weekend after the family reunion, I spoke at the West Virginia State Convention in Reading, West Virginia. And my whole family was there. I had brothers, there were several nephews and nieces, and many, many, many members of my family are now in the wonderful program of Al-Anon. And my father had never heard me speak. And he came. He's 88 years of age, and he came, and he listened to me. And when it was over, he came up to me and put his arms around me and said, I love you very much. And I'm so very proud of you for what you've done for other people, especially those in our family. I've got it all. If you're a guy and you're having a hard time, and it's hard to be in relationships, and it's hard to pray, and it's hard to do things, look at your relationship with your dad. You know, the healing in this program, I get to a lot of places, I get to talk to a lot of people, and it seems to me that where members of Alcoholics Anonymous shortchange themselves the most is in the eighth and ninth step. And to do that eighth and ninth step, you know, I grew up in a church I was so angry with I couldn't see straight. And one day I realized that it wasn't them, it was me. And I went to find somebody to make an amends to. And I used to ridicule and criticize religious people. And I knew I'd gone back and taken a degree in philosophy and theology out of Georgetown. And I knew that there was a theology professor I'd had, a young hep guy who would understand the deep significance of the humble act I was about to perform. And he did retreats at the retreat house down in Faulkner, Maryland. And so I went down to find him, and I was looking for him, and I could never find him. And I kept going by this room, and there was an old guy sitting in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was supposed to talk to him. And I went in, his name was Jim, and I said, Father, do you have a few moments? And he said, of course. And I pulled up a rocking chair, and I told him my story, and I told him why I was there. I said the horrible things I've said about people like you, and I said, I'm so very sorry. And he started to cry. And he put his Bible down, and he got up, and he pulled me up, and he put his arms around me, and he began to pat me. And he said, God sent you. I said, excuse me? He said, God sent you. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years. He said, I have an illness that's going to allow me to go home soon. He said, I was just asking God, as I understand him, where have I failed you? And he said, it occurs to me over these 50 years that too many times I forgot what my higher power told me. He told me to forget the 99 who agree with you and go after the one who's lost. He said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. It, yes, I went through life like a tornado, and I caused damage that no human being should be allowed to cause. But I get to go through life like a whispering wind, bringing healing. And I knew, and I had known before this, but I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that the people who say this is a selfish program don't understand this program. they don't understand anything about the spiritual life. We have three pages in our big book where selfishness and self-centeredness and self is mentioned 23 times. That's not what we are. Not when we're well. Not when we're at our best. It's the way we are sometimes. But when we're at our best, we're just the opposite of that. It's all about others. And a priest taught me so much that day that a guy like me could be of help to a man like him. It's beyond the realm. It's beyond the realm. Let me tell you one more thing and then I'll sit down and shut up. My brother Terry, who tried this program a number of times, could never quite make it. And I hadn't thought about it in a while, but my friend Patrick reminded me of it. But Terry wasn't even able to make amends to him. Whenever I go home, Terry would leave, because I guess it's hard to have a brother who's sober. And Terry was living on the streets, and my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, and my wife had never even met Terry. And she finally got to meet him, and she's an Al-Anon, so she loved him right away. And he looked rough. I mean, he had beaten pretty badly, and he'd been a good boxer. He was a good boxer. Made some money boxing, but you know, he was a drunk, and he was 40 some years old, and he's still thinking he was a boxer, and people beat him half to death in bars and things. He had no teeth or anything, and I was trying to get a moment with him to make direct amends to him, and I couldn't seem to do that. He was pretty fast on his feet, and suddenly we're at the reunion, and everybody's there but Terry, and all these kids my parents raised came, and the place was packed, and about 11 or 8 o'clock that evening, one brother came to me and said, Terry's here and he's drunk. I said, of course he's drunk, he's an alcoholic. And he said, but why has he got to be like that now? And I said, I'll tell you why, because he's been down the street for hours trying to get the courage to come here. I said, he's got to love mom and dad an awful lot to come here like that. And they woke up and took him in, and so I made direct amends to my brother Terry, and shortly after that, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and I went up to see him, got away from everybody else, and I went and spent some time with my dear brother Terry, and I was able to talk to him, and he had some questions for me. And I'll never forget the first question he asked me. He said, you really believe in God, don't you? I said, oh, I know. I said, I don't believe, I know. And he said, God loves you. I said, yeah. And then he asked a question. Could God love a guy like me? And I was able to give him the good news. And that is, God couldn't not love you. He couldn't be God if he didn't love you exactly the way you are. And I said, he loves me the way I am, but he loves me too much to let me stay that way. And he asked some other questions about things that we grew up with, which are very important to us. And he asked me if I had any of those things. I just happened to have a rosary and some things, and I showed him how to use it again. And I asked him for a favor. I said, could I hug you? How desperately I'd wanted to hug him for so many years. And he got out of bed, and he was frail. He weighed less than 100 pounds. And I put my arms around him. And, you know, you don't hug for long when you're a practicing alcoholic. And I remember something I learned in theology. There are two kinds of time. One is chronological time, chronos, which I'm well out of. The other is something called kairos, which is God's time. And God's time is always now. I only hugged my brother Terry for a few seconds, but I hugged him forever in God's time. And when I left, he said to me, you know, I don't think I have to drink anymore. And I said, you know, I don't think you do either. And in the next 6 months, he made amends to everybody he loved. And he died the way I want to die, sober, in a clean bed, surrounded by people who loved him. What a program we have. What a place where they take people beyond the pale. And God uses us as much as we let him. And you know what I know is that without you I'm nothing. I love God and I love my church and everything. But where he's put me to serve is here with you. And the reason is because I am you. And I'm privileged to be here. Thank you very much.